It's all good for right now.
Okay.
Some won't be up there. I just wanted to make sure. That was loud and clear. All right. First, I would like to present you with a book. Not that you don't have enough books, but this particular book was written by a friend of Thomas Becket, and he wrote it for Thomas Becket. For Thomas Becket didn't have, in this author's opinion, enough intellectual self-defense to do what he was doing, and he was trying to help him out. And his name is John of Salisbury, and it was written in the 12th century. And I thought, if there was such a thing as reincarnation, this guy reminds me of you, and that you would greatly enjoy this.
I will read it with pleasure.
12th century defense of logic and reason in a time of irrationality. And I took the liberty of, just in the prologue, I marked a couple pages there that has some, there's a couple quotes in there where he basically lays out why he's doing it. I thought, you know, I got a chuckle out of it. And I thought, you could always use a good laugh now and then.
This will be the very next thing I read.
All right, now I have one last bit of housekeeping. Let me see. If you could read that to the camera while at the same time holding this mug, and it'll be the intro for the episode. Or you can change it however you like.
Give me the high sign. Hi, I'm John Taylor Gatto, and this is What You've Been Missing.
Awesome. Yesterday, the name of R. Gordon Wasson came up, and you raised your eyebrows. What does that name mean to you?
Well, it means to me Soma, the magic mushroom, and that Wasson wasn't some fringe nut, but some Wall Street heavy hitter. So I read it with great pleasure, not once, but until it fell apart.
Before you leave today, I have a DVD for you. I just have to burn it. I have the folder made and everything. And in there, I put Wasson's Russia Mushrooms and History book, which is very hard to find on PDF. So I just thought you'd get a kick out of it.
I will get a big kick out of it.
What does the name Anthony Sutton mean to you?
Actually, I corresponded briefly with Sutton. He made the contact after he read Underground History. And his books about the rise of Wall Street and the rise of the Soviet Union and Wall Street and the rise of Nazism were important parts in a slow process of overcoming my own skepticism. I mean, I had all the pieces, or I had many of the pieces, rather, but they seemed to add up to a reality that I could find no hint of recognition of. And in the copious reading I had done and kept current, why weren't there any references to this at all? Or occasionally when someone like Ramsey Clark would seem to breach the wall of security, Ramsey was toast. He was marginalized. No one ever mentioned Ramsey again. He wasn't a guest on any show.
Well, the same thing happened to Sutton, because he worked for the Hoover Institute at Stanford University, which is very prestigious. And then once they started reading his work, they're like, you can't write this. And he said, that's the ticket out of here. I must go find out what's going on. And I think he wrote like nine or more books on these various subjects. And when you see how Wall Street funded the Bolsheviks, and Wall Street was funding the Nazis and the Bushes and the Harrimans and all those families that were also eugenicists, and the ones that want to do compulsory schooling and tell you what to do with your kids and all these other things, like there's a very small knit group. And once you try to understand the philosophy of what makes them the utopia that are trying to shape everyone else's lives and violate their volition, I thought it was like it's overwhelming to discover that. But then you discover someone like Lysander Spooner or Bastiat, Frederick Bastiat, and read the book The Law, and it's so simple. And yet, if you don't understand the simplicity, it's easy for these other groups to take it away from us.
Yes, very easy to marginalize as who has time for this nonsense. I mentioned in our session yesterday that as I was poking around in, for other reasons, in the history of American adoption, I kept running into the people who were the architects of American schooling. And I said, what possible correspondence? The chapter in Underground History, Daughters of the Barons of Runnymede, is actually a kind of lens into my brain trying to prove to myself there was some sense in following this road. If the heirs of the people who fought at Runnymede had maintained an 850-year continuity, and then I found other organizations that had, I said, it's possible that someone with an agenda other than this. So,
who was Ignatius Loyola?
Well, Loyola was the founder of the Army of Jesus, the Jesuits who penetrated the Reformation and eventually produced the phenomenon in history records as the Counter-Reformation. They slowed the momentum down because the Reformation really is founded, although Calvin is the eminence grise, Luther's every man his own priest is this wild declaration of radicalism to get rid of the religious priesthood is to get rid of all middlemen, yes.
There were many countries that outlawed the Jesuits in the late 1700s, and one of those was the province or electorate of Bavaria. And then there was a Jesuit professor of canon law named Adam Weishaupt, right, who created a group. And what influence specifically has that group had on the education system?
Well, to pursue that line would require so many illusions. I prefer not to enter an area where I can't field the hardest questions with substantive facts, but certainly the sense of powers behind the scenes, very, very strong. Let me give you a few specifics. It's been clear since the beginning of standardized testing that the tests do not predict. And the best American, the most prestigious American universities have either dismissed it or kept it in pro forma place. But actually, as Harvard and Princeton told me, it's not a significant determinant. They just don't want to rock the boat that hold, the glue that holds this pyramid together. They don't predict, then why is 10% of the school year and school budget devoted to exerting stress on so many millions of people and through the children, their families, and why do so many innocently ignorant school teachers say this will determine your future when it only does if you convince yourself that it determines your future. It has no predictive power at all other than to signal this is someone who will memorize whatever you ask him to memorize. This is a useful skill, an anti-skill.
In the book, The Leipzig Connection, Basics in Education, toward the end of the book, after talking about Pestalozzi, it talks about Pestalozzi's mentor, who was Johann Caspar Lavater, who was working and experimenting on Swiss lower privileged children in a universal schooling system. He was also a grand master of the Illuminati. So since Pestalozzi and Lavater and all these other key figures that were in the Prussian education system,
yeah,
were also members of the Prussian Illuminati, it just seemed natural to see the takeover and undermining of nationhood of our society, the taking away of our identity through the school system is also making we as a nation incoherent. And it just seems like there is a very militaristic strategy that's been in place a long time.
And notice what the specific mechanism is. It's an artificial extension of childhood, theoretically to the grave, but certainly beyond the point where learning anything is easy. As long as you indulge childish fears and childish appetites long enough, you've effectively rendered somebody harmless. You can see it in its crudest form in the military, in the training of recruits, or in fraternities, in the hazing of freshmen. But actually, yesterday I hope we talked about Richard Branson and the turning point of his life at age 4, when his mother drops him miles from home. Throughout most of human history, anywhere on the planet, childhood is over by the age of 7, and even in the most permissive cultures, it's over by the age of 11 or 12. People are, even in our own country, at the beginning of the 20th century, a substantial number of young women at the age of 13 were married or becoming married. I'm thinking in particular of, I'm thinking of a 18-volume History of the World that used to be, for 20 years, the premium of Book of the Month Club, written by a husband and wife team. And still, a rather respectable history. In an inside historians say it's not bad history. It's very, very.
They also do a history of philosophy set?
Yes.
I have it. Gene O'Denning just sent it to me last week. I just scanned it in. It's on my desk if you want to go get it.
All we need is the last name, and it'll trigger. And in any case, the fellow who had been trained, I think, at UChicago as a historian, marries his wife, who becomes his co-writer and
Durant, Will Durant.
Will Durant and Ariel. Ariel was either 13 or 15. There's a dispute on the internet about how old, she wasn't older than 15, and I suspect she was 13 when they married. Was Will some form of sexual oppressor? No. Instead of going to junior high school, Ariel studied professional historiography and its protocols. And she was a full partner in the writing, and Will died, predeceased her 10 years, and she continued to lecture, having begun her productive life when people began their productive lives. To extend this to the late teens or beyond the late teens is to fly in the face of the first admiral in American history being in charge of a warship.
Farragut.
Farragut at the age of 12. Or George Washington being the surveyor of Culpeper County, Virginia in his mid-teens.
Very entrepreneurial attitudes that they
Or
got.
Jefferson running a plantation, his parents both dead, 250 employees. He's 12 or 13. But these examples go on and on and on. Why have we marginalized the young, who whatever they lack in experience more than make up for in resilience, in acuity? They bring new eyes to old situations, which is the secret of scientific invention. So it's done because they're the most dangerous. They're the least overlaid with these conditioning, and of course that must have been understood way, way back in history. Alexander the Great, after all.
You're noticing, you're observing that values have changed since the time of our founding fathers, who were literate, autonomous, entrepreneurial. They also grew hemp. They knew the value of hemp.
Oh, to my. This George Robert, he did it for medicinal purposes, so I assume it wasn't.
And Jefferson traveled the planet collecting different strains, and they had contests, and they wrote letters about their, you know, hey, I've grown this strain, and it does this, and they're like competing. And so the fact that you're not taught about this in school, and the role that hemp played in making the sails and the clothing and everything was hemp dependent.
Oh, it's a miraculous fiber. There are some rather sober accounts of the lengths to which the Hearst family went, because they were the largest forest owners in the country. They supplied the wood pulp for newspapers, but hemp newspapers are infinitely superior to wood pulp, so that they moved heaven and earth to create the narrative of reefer madness.
So if we're using wood pulp paper to make books these days, we're not only killing trees, which eat CO2 and produce oxygen to make paper towels and toilet paper and all these other things beyond books, but I noticed that a lot of the books that are printed recently, the pages are disintegrating. And when you get old books from the 1800s, 1700s that are printed on hemp paper, they're still pretty, you know, existent. We have a Johnson's Dictionary from 1848. And it's not printed on the same wood pulp acid, you know, paper that we have today. So can you comment on, they undermine education, but they're also undermining just our ability to get our hands on the books to educate ourselves, closing libraries and using types of paper that, you know, basically turn to dust.
Oh, yes. And there's been, since I've been in college in the 50s, there's been a prevailing wise guy ethic that you don't actually need to read these old books, because there are plenty of abstracts, digests of these old books in existence, and that will give you the guts of the old book. Well, let's take Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. What the digests don't give you is the wealthiest, most powerful man in the world. I mean, I don't know if that confluence has ever existed after Aurelius, saying that nothing you can buy is worth having, and nobody you can order around with your power is worth associating with. That's a rather acid.
So how old were you when you first met Marcus Aurelius?
I was initially in translation in sixth grade in a coal mining town in western Pennsylvania, where it was offered in translation, and of course it's eminently readable. And then in ninth grade, there was an option of reading it in Latin or doing something else. So my mother insisted that I read it, Julius Caesar in Latin, Gallius Dominus Suis and Partes Tres at 75, Quorum Unum in Colon Belgia. We had to memorize the early part of it. But Caesar's Gallic Wars isn't some old piece of fustian that, you know, if you're an elitist, you read to plug into the ancient world. It establishes the principle that a weaker force can whip a larger force by dividing.
And being better prepared.
Yeah, you can set the larger force against one another. And you see that in schooling, the ordinary classes are set against one another by constant, meaningless testing and small, inconsequential prizes being given to the people who test best and wiggle their hands in the air, so that the ordinary classes are divided for a period of 12 years through meaningless competition. I noticed when I was in basic training in the Army and was told that I was going to learn in 3 hours how to take a rifle with 57 parts of blindfold and put it back together, I knew that I could not do that. I knew I could not do that. And yet, in a room with 500 other scared young people. We all did it. And they didn't say, and he finished first. You know, the important thing is, what do we learn that's enhanced by competition? I mean, what real do we learn? It gets in the way because now your rank becomes a factor rather than the quality of what you've learned. I made these ideas clear to 13-year-olds at all times and found that after about 90 days, they became as addicted to ideas and the whys of things as I was. Whenever a new idea would emerge in the classroom, this is quite literally true, I would grab a piece of chalk and write it on the wall. I'd climb a ladder and write it on the ceiling. Inside of that first 90 days, there were hundreds of digests of ideas everywhere, on the floors when there was no room left, front, back, sides of the room. I had world maps and national maps, and I could leap up and point to the origin of the idea as we know it, or simultaneously they came. As I say, it was roughly 90 days when classes that were considered the stupidest, people who'd never eaten off a tablecloth in their life, were actually, they were hot to talk about ideas. We couldn't have that. How could we maintain the social order and the economic order if we had people who became fully alive when they were young and could get up when they're knocked down? You know, I think a lot of the problem, it's very easy to assign this completely to sinister motives, and there are certainly sinister motives at work, but I think part of it is the problem of how we would manage a society that didn't require managing. And I don't think anyone's been able to solve that problem. The early America probably did it better than anyone we have easy access to.
Because I think it's not about anarchy. Anarchy is just a void or a vacuum of government. It's about being autonomous. And if you take away the government, it doesn't automatically give people critical thinking or the self-reliance that they need and the compassionate communication that they need to work together with other people to achieve goals.
Right. So
in your explanation of how you learned the most powerful lesson of doing the impossible, you knew you couldn't do that. And after an hour or so, you had just done something that you knew you couldn't do.
I knew I couldn't do it.
You took that experience and you taught younger people that they can do that, because now they have more years. You had to be at least 18 to be in the Army. Now you're teaching 13-year-olds that the things that you know you can't do, you don't really know that.
Right.
And you need to get that up here first.
Right.
So the question that I would follow up with is, in your third interview on Gnostic Media with Jan Ervin, I heard you mention these words, trivium and quadrivium, and I thought it maybe is something that was off your radar, but you spoke eloquently about it. And so where do you have familiarity with the trivium and quadrivium, and what does it mean to you?
I went to Jesuit boarding school in third grade. So I'm between the ages of 7.5 and 8.5. years old, and the curriculum, reflecting back on it, which I first began to do 15, 20 years ago, the intellectual diet was not modified in any way for our tender years. And the devices of discipline and motivation that would be used in an authoritarian world, they were not chary of using, but I do believe that their hearts were in the right place. I remember being humiliated. I told you privately about this yesterday, by a Jesuit brother from St. Vincent's College, which is across the street from Xavier Academy, where I went and was beaten on a daily basis by the Ursuline nuns, sometimes for mispronouncing French there. But the brother was talking to us in the middle of the Second World War about the causes of the First World War. And he had written a list of causes on the board. I had a magnificent memory before drink intervened. And he said, could somebody face the back of the room now and tell us all the causes? And I, with my memory, I did, word for word. And he burst into harsh kind of laughter, and he said, you fool, you believe me. He erased the board and said, these are the causes of the war. Now could you do it? And now, chastened, I did, a lot less confidently. And this time, the room exploded with his scorn. He did it again. He erased the board. He said, you will never know the causes until you embed yourself into the primary documents and see how complicated a thing this is. That changed my life. I only wish I might have had a second year there, but
before you can form your logical understanding, he said, you need to get in check with the knowledge, the actual grammar. What are the artifacts? Yeah. Where are these things documented? What's primary sources?
And it probably has occurred to other groups, but the intellectual part of the universal Christian religion, the Catholic Church, had a respect for scholarship. And what happens as you collect data is that it forms itself into patterns, and if you record the patterns and test them to see that they hold true, eventually that suggests behaviors. So that they created two formulae, a basic formula to which Dorothy Sayers, and I'd urge all your listeners to read her essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. She's a marvelous detective story writer, and the detective stories really aren't genre stories. They're a comedy of manners about the British upper classes. But the trivium was becoming comfortable with a pattern of thinking in which you could dispel confusion. And then the quadrivium was pushing it farther into specialized areas. One of the huge mistakes that schooling makes, even homeschooling, is to organize the agenda and the goals in terms of subject learnings, English, math, social studies, science, because those categories, while better than chaos, are so crude, they tend to mask what you're actually after. Take the universal study of the English language. What you're after is a mastery of the written language, the spoken language, and your own writing. So you've got these three divisions, and now if you're after those things, your measurement's not through memory, it's through performance, which is so much more accurate. As we spoke about a little earlier in this session, the standardized tests aren't predictive, and every first-class university knows that. You don't select people because they scored here on the SATs or whatever other tests are administered, because they end up disappointing you, and you waste people who who actually...
In real life, we don't use standardized tests to make decisions, whereas you actually do use the trivium to observe, to process that information, and to make informed decisions.
Right. And while there are personal variants, so I think the fundamental thing, as every philosopher in human history has said, is know yourself. This is the fundament. Now you can take principles like trivium and quadrivium, and you can do a personal adaptation of the, you know how they will work for you. But the course I actually followed at the beginning was to say, I know this is not good for the kids I've been hired to teach. And where will I find an unerring structure? I said, obviously it will be in the most expensive elite private boarding schools. So I made a 10-year study, although it paid off at the end of the first year, and I distilled the 12 secrets of the boarding school curriculum of power. Now, I'm talking about not private schools versus public schools at all, because most private schools follow the template that public schools laid down. I'm talking about the inner circle, 20 or so. Let me just name a few of them. I'm talking about Groton, where Franklin Delano Roosevelt emerged. I'm talking about St. Paul's, where the senator from Massachusetts who ran for president, the tall, skinny guy, John Kerry, emerged. I'm talking about Andover, where the Bush family went. I'm talking about Choate, where John F. Kennedy emerged. I'm talking about one that not one person in 10,000 has ever heard of, Episcopal in Virginia, where John McCain, the populist, give me a break, emerged. I learned about Episcopal from the sports section of a newspaper. I'm looking for the next Pittsburgh Pirate defeat, and suddenly I see a tiny item that says it's the homecoming football game for Episcopal Prep School in Virginia. 25,000 alumni showed up. I said, wait, it's got to be a misprint. I mean, I can understand 1,000, 25,000 people came from all over the world for a high school alumni game. So now I start to look and I discover that Episcopal, it's the naked revelation of the importance of religious tradition in upscale education. Over half of the elite boarding schools in the country and all of the inner circle ones are grounded on religion, almost all on the Anglican religion, which isn't faith-based. It was put together by committees arguing about what must have been in God's mind. but also there's a respectable number that are Quaker-based. Now, here we're talking about a tiny fraction of the population, no more than 100,000 people. It's produced in the 20th century two presidents. How is that even possible statistically? What would a bookie say the odds of this little splinter group who we all are taught are innocent and unworldly and pious? Well, so anyway, so I got the 12. See, I'd like to, if possible, go through a few of these because I adapted them instantly to Harlem kids and almost immediately began to produce results. It was roughly 90 days because at first Harlem kids don't believe that anything useful to them is going to happen in school. But after about 90 days, these kids start winning competitions with the inner circle kids of the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Instead of being amazed and wondered about, I'm called in and accused of child abuse. What on earth are these people doing? You must have written that for, I said, I will confess. I corrected the spelling and the punctuation. But that steel trap set of ideas proving the case, it's not mine. I'm not up to that standard there. So I began to get hot water ever since. Let me share a few of these. We all are vaguely aware that literacy is at the heart of an intellectual inner life. But what we don't understand is that prior to the First World War, literacy commonly was divided into passive literacy, reading, and active literacy, speaking and writing. And none of us are aware that in colonial days, to teach active literacy to ordinary people was a crime. Why? Because reading, you're locked in your own head, and you still have the benefit of being able to read the boss's instructions about what to do. But if you can speak well, as our current president can, or write well, you can reach way beyond your own skull and recruit allies. That's a no-no for ordinary people. They're supposed to be so inarticulate, or their writing to look so funny with ink blots and things in it that no one treats them seriously. So strong competencies in the active literacies are at the core of elite private boarding schools like Groton, St. Paul's, Choate, Lawrenceville, Gunnery, Hotchkiss, and each one of those schools, by the way, has some legendary tycoon as a patron, or sometimes more than one. Canton, Connecticut is J.P. Morgan's baby. So, and this is in no particular order. Insight into all institutional forms. You're supposed to know the logic, the steps that we arrived at a prison system or a library system or all the other, the military system, obviously. Third, here's a secret. Some of your listeners, watchers, viewers will be school teachers. And if you teach history or literature, you will run into a great deal of difficulty moving kids. But if you approach those subjects and share this with the kids, that what we're after here is not a good story or memorizing details from Jane Austen for the test. We're after a theory of human nature. And anyone who's written a book that lasts more than their own time has spent years closely observing people in interaction, and the trace left behind is an insight that you might spend a lifetime and never have. So that's what we're after, a theory of human nature drawn from history or philosophy or literature or law, or the greatest trove that's unexamined is theology. I used to go to auctions, and there'd be boxes of religious books, 50 cents or a dollar from a century ago, and nobody wanted them at auctions. But I bought them because they were cheap, and one day I have a barn in upstate New York. I picked one up idly, and I was in the hands of an intense thinker who was drawing on all history and philosophy to create an insight into human nature there. And I said, interesting that theology is something that we don't regard at all if we're ordinary people. So a few other of the secrets of the boarding school curriculum of power, mastery of the social forms. And I would say it didn't take more than 2 days to take kids who had never eaten off a tablecloth and get them to see that the signs they give off when there's a egg spilled on the shirt, or when they walk down the street listening to the radio, or when they're too aggressive in approaching somebody, shuts off opportunity. They're like little badges that I don't want to speak to that person. And a lot of what we consider as racial or ethnic prejudice is simply that the disguise of these social forms is unknown to the person who then is discriminated against. And I said, don't believe me. I said, I'm gonna instruct you in a superficial gloss of how to approach people, and then the intellectual excuse we'll use is I'm sending you out of school for days to gather data for statistical processing. We're going to test the local comparison with what the New York Times says the nation is thinking, and I'll teach you the elementary statistics in one class session that you need. And it's a legitimate project, but meanwhile, you don't want to approach somebody and have them jump back or say, if you don't get away from me, I'll call the police. And that's what you think will happen because of the overt racial prejudice on the liberal west side of Manhattan. But it won't happen, I guarantee. Nor did it. The transition, I won't say it was 100%, but it surely was 80% simply from having a gloss on these social forms. And then this should tickle people watching this segment. Then suddenly I saw that the rules of access to the great institutions of New York City by young people, which required, let's say, at the sub-treasury building where the gold is kept down in Wall Street, one teacher for every 5 students. Well, a public school class of 30 students, you're not going to muster 6 teachers. But I said to the kids, how do they know you're not a teacher? Well, we're only 13. Nobody knows that. They know it because you're chewing gum with your mouth open. They know it because you're scratching your head. They know it because you slouch. They know it because you giggle. They know it because you carry a notebook that falls on the ground every few minutes and paper goes everywhere. Why don't we master what a college student, who could be a student teacher, what signs they would give off? They'd carry a clipboard. They'd cock it at an arrogant angle on their hip. They would be slightly nasty in taking attendance every few minutes, or saying, when your mother hears about this, Jack. You know, I said, let's see if we can pick 5 people out of this class and penetrate security at the sub-treasury building, at the mayor's office, anywhere. We were never caught, not once. Now, the Bronx Zoo says 1 for every 15 kids, but how are you going to even get 2 teachers to take kids to the Bronx Zoo there? Well, it's easy if the kids can shift from being 13 to being arrogant college student teachers, never caught in 8 years of doing this.
Well, that's real self-esteem, because I'm real confidence from experience, and to be able to go into Columbia, sit in the back of a class, and see what college is like before you have to go to college, takes away a lot of anxiety.
Now, I don't know why you said that, but we were only 20 blocks from Columbia, and I have a degree from Columbia, so I understood that the law school classes are the 300 people in these banks of seats, and the only way, no one takes attendance there. Your grades on the test are evidence of whether you've been attending or not. But if you sit there slouch and pulling gum out of your mouth, yeah, someone will say, who are you? Never caught once. So our age, this artificial extension of childhood that we talked about at the beginning of this this particular session, is a secret of crowd control, where people become their own prisoners by adopting the cultural signs that they're immature or they're not of our group, and simply by seeing these things as languages. There isn't one English language. You know, there are 10 that are modified according to the, you know, and someone like Obama, how, I'm not sure, they understand this and they can shift effortlessly from one idiom to another. And I would say that to the kids. I would say, look, here's why you're reading English poetry. Now, there are a lot of reasons, but here's why we're doing it. You're going to find that the ordinary unit of meaning in the English language is 3 hard stresses long, or sometimes 4, but often it's 2, 3, or 4. But as you enter the realm of intellect and you have more to say or more nuances to say, you need larger units of meaning. 5, that's iambic pentameter. Even 6, that's hexameters. There, the Greeks used 7 septameters, and I want you to feel that, and you'll feel it by reading and memorizing some of this poetry. You'll have the models built into your head to shift back and forth according to your audience there. Shakespeare, to the ignorant, writes iambic pentameter lines. And one of the reasons you don't want to even look at Shakespeare is all the lines seem to be pretty much the same length. But I'm going to teach you something that he knew 4 centuries ago. It looks like they're all the same length, but there's a breath pause in this speech after 2 hard beats. The next breath pause is 12 before you've delivered your meaning. 3, 4. There's this inner jazz at work underneath this regular pattern. You can learn to do that. Once someone exposes the secret to you, that's half the game. And the other half of the game is simply building the models into yourself so you don't have to think, now here. And yet we use an exercise that if I tell you immediately turned horribly dull writers into at least modestly interesting writers, and it's totally mathematical. I said, it'll take you a while to incorporate what I just said. So what I'm going to ask you to do is write 1 to 20 on 20 pieces of paper, put them in some sort of container, and draw them out at random, and then list what you've drawn out at random on a, and I said, now you're going home, not for homework, but to learn this massive skill, and you're going to write a paper on X subject, and if 1 is the first number that came out, the first sentence will be one word long, one beat long. If the second one's 20, it'll be 20 long. Immediately, these remember, I had to read 120 of these things at a time. And one of the reasons they were horrible is they were all, everyone had either a 3 or a 4 unit or a mixture in there. Now they had the kind of jazz that readers aren't completely conscious of, but they record as something interesting about, even when he's writing about a milk separator. And you as a filmmaker, remember Eisenstein's film of the peasants watching milk being separated on a Russian farm in the 1920s. Why is it so awfully interesting? Because he understood things that the eye is looking at the movement of light around the screen. It's looking at entrances and exits. 13-year-old kids from Harlem can master these secrets just as well as 25-year-old Harvard students can. And then they become preternaturally sophisticated. What on earth? How do you know these things? Because they're our birthright. We're biologically equipped to learn this way. Unless somebody sticks their oar in and intervenes and says, read Jack London and memorize.
That's the school system. We've all heard about the hardware. What's going on with this camera?
Okay, I just need you to, for a minute, you could just reframe this camera, because I think something happened.
No, when I came in, the camera was moved. I guess someone was monitoring on it or something.
Either way, I just want you to make sure that you focus.
I think, and I won't be as windy and the rest, but I think that everyone will profit, and you'll see some evidences of the trivium at work here. These are the 12 secrets of the elite boarding school curriculum of power. Are we on yet, or
just 1 second? We'll be back on.
Because the next one,
that's what people don't learn in public school, specifically, like, what is different. They're doing this, and this is about their success in life and managing the other people who don't know it.
Oh yeah,
right.
Well, the next one will be an absolute eye-opener that took me about 5 years to tease out of the admissions procedures at Sarah Lawrence or, you know, the other inner circle colleges.
You guys might as well do a tape change now.
Yeah, no, mine's out.
I'll turn these lights off.